I want to introduce the featured speaker, Ellen David Friedman, tell you a little bit about her, and then I have a lot of questions for her, and then we're going to open it up to questions from all of you. And thank you very much to the Book Fair for hosting this event, and I've never been here, and it's very cool. Ellen has been a labor organizer essentially since she graduated from college in 1974. Now it's over 50 years ago. She had been part of the student left and was very involved in the anti-war movement. She moved to Vermont and volunteered for United Electrical Workers, a union with a long history of organizing the machine tool industry in Vermont. She later became an organizer with AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. In 1986, she left AFSCME to manage the campaign of a very obscure figure, public figure, named Bernie Sanders. He ran for governor of Vermont, so she managed his campaign. And Ellen has worked with and for Sanders for many years, building the Vermont Progressive Party along the way. She was then recruited by the Vermont affiliate of the National Education Association. She spent a lot of time in Vermont, where she worked for 20 years organizing school support staff and teachers and organizing dozens of new unions of teaching assistants. NEA is the largest union in the U.S. with about 3 million members. After she left the NEA in 2006, Ellen went to China to visit my godparents. Just kidding. She spent parts of 10 consecutive years in Guangzhou province teaching, setting up an international labor research center in Sun Yat-sen University School of Government, and working for the Chinese labor movement in various capacities at various levels. She was ordered by the National Security Police to leave China in December 2015. So over the last half century, Ellen has worked closely with thousands of union members, staffers, and officers. She has worked on innumerable campaigns, elections, strikes, and community coalitions. And Labor Notes is a big part of her work now and has been for many years. It's a media and education project that has championed bottom-up, democratic, and militant unionism since the late 1970s. To quote Ellen, "I found my home in Labor Notes as soon as it appeared on the scene, and I've never left it." She's currently chair of the Labor Notes board and a frequent contributor to Labor Notes magazine. Ellen is here to talk about her new book, Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. Is it ever not hard? Okay. Published jointly by PM Press and Labor Notes. Striking illustrations by Fernando Martí. And Ellen, welcome. Let's give Ellen a nice warm welcome. And I want to start with, you talk about a lot of things in this book, both kind of big picture and kind of very, you know, the nitty gritty of organizing. Let's talk about the power of workers. What power, what potential power do workers have?
Ah, is that a rhetorical question?
Not as such.
So the potential power of workers, of course, is to cut off the flow of all capital in a capitalist society, which is the source of all both economic and political power. And therefore, we have to think of as workers as the linchpin of the economy and the political economy. And when we go to work every day, we are freely handing that bounty to our employers. And in return for that, are given the great gift of feeling insecure at almost every moment of our lives. Will we keep this job? Will this job pay us enough to live on? Will we have health insurance? Will we be able to pay the rent? Will we have anything to retire on? So the power that we have, the first and most important power, is to recognize that relationship to those who are buying our labor, that if we turn it off, we can force them to concede things to us. So that's been my worldview.
So, you know, many of us have issues with our boss, right? And we consider it sort of a personal thing. But you have a section with the heading, it's not personal. So that the problem is not that the boss is a bad person personally, and it's not personal about you either. So what's the real problem?
So, you know, starting with this analysis, the idea of capitalism and how it works, one of the things I have found that it is most consistently important to remember is that we are just born in a system. We grow up in the system. We are taught and encouraged and reminded all the time how to behave. And this means we are existing within a structure that we didn't design, that we have very little control over, really. We're made to feel we have very little control over. And to the degree that we are happy with it, fine, you just accept its terms, you accept its rules. To the degree that it's not working for you, either you feel like you're being forced to do things you don't want to do, you're forced to do those things under conditions that are not acceptable to you, you're bullied, you're sexually harassed, you are victimized for reasons of race or sexual identity, for any of those other things. If you're working under conditions, even where you are forced to do things in the nature of your job that are inconsistent with your values or your professional training, how you're asked to treat your coworkers, if any of those things are not working for you, then the question is, where do you place the blame? How do you understand this? And how do you change it? And what I've found over time is that if you think it is anything personal, like the boss is an or my coworkers are horrible, or, you know, I'm working with someone who's greedy and arrogant and so on, and you keep it personal, you're not seeing this underlying structure of power, and therefore you're going to respond personally. You're going to get angry, you're going to be resentful, you're going to act out, and none of those things are consistent with good organizing. So you want to do good organizing, you want to change the relationships of power. Better to see it as a structural question, not personal.
Does a good organizer encourage complaining? You know, is their task partly to stir up resentment and rage?
Funny, we were just discussing this. So we have a dear comrade and colleague here from Ithaca, Calix, sitting right over here, who I've known as an organizer for almost a decade. And Calix has been at the center of a very successful union campaign that just took place in Ithaca, the organizing of a small but really vital human services agency called Family and Children's Services that provides tremendously important care to a community of people with great needs. They just successfully organized a union, like, last week, I think their vote was certified. And we were just having this conversation not an hour ago. I do have very strong beliefs about this. Does anybody here in the room think of yourself as an organizer? I guess I should see that. Hands up first, somewhat. Many approaches to organizing will try and train you as an organizer to believe that your job is to agitate. Does that sound familiar? That your job is to, like, get people around you sort of upset and angry and focus your anger at the boss so that people will come together to fight the boss. I actually don't subscribe to that because anger is short and it's unpredictable. And if you're stirring up anger, who's to say that anger will only be focused at the boss? It might end up being focused at coworkers. It might be focused at yourself. It is not a very sustainable, healthy emotion. So what I have seen works much better if you want to build power, you have to build sustained relationships over time in which people can get over being afraid so they can take action together. That's what organizing is people coming together in a group, getting over being afraid, finding a common purpose, and taking action to solve a problem. So to sustain that, let's build it on something other than anger. Why don't we build it on the idea of trusting one another, of becoming familiar with one another's values, with supporting one another's humanism and impulses towards healthy, strong relationships, solidarity, generosity, compassion. Those are will build sustainable connections between people. So people will always come to you with hot complaints. That's fine. You should listen, of course, and agree. But don't stimulate it, don't reinforce it, don't cultivate resentment. Cultivate confidence in each other.
Building relationships and listening seem to be really key facets of what you think a good organizer ought to do. Can you talk about each of those?
Building relationships and listening. Well, okay. So many of you in the room think of yourself as organizers. And have any of you been organized? That is, have you ever been approached by someone who is trying to organize you into something? Most of us have, right? As either an organizer or someone who is being organized, sometimes at the end of these conversations, you are either waiting to ask or you are waiting for someone to ask you, what is the ask that's going to be in this conversation? Like, hey, how are you doing? How are things going? What do you think about this latest problem at the workplace? And so on. And you talk and you listen. And then at the end, you say, so will you sign this petition? Will you sign this letter? Will you come to this meeting? This is what I think of as transactional or instrumental. You are talking to someone in order to get them to do something that you want them to do. Do people recognize that? I hate that. I think that's wrong. Organizing should not be trying to get somebody else to do something that I want them to do. That's wrong for obvious reasons. We are not the boss of each other. Relationships of solidarity among coworkers or tenants or people in a community organization, they should not look like boss relationships. Bosses ask us to do stuff, and they have a lot of power to coerce us to do stuff. Between ourselves, no. So listening for me is not, how can I get you? How can I figure out how to hook you into my project? Listening for me has to do with what actually is going on for you. What are you experiencing? What are your values? What do you feel at this moment you need to advance? And then is there anything I can do to help you do that? Anything I can help you do? Can I just listen and witness? Can I reflect back to you some things that I'm hearing? Can I encourage you? Can I offer some insight? Can I be critical, you know, in a way that I think might be helpful? So that's what I think a useful organizing conversation is about. The other was about building relationships. Is that right? Yeah, so the building of relationships I talk about quite a lot in this book. And what I say is, again, you may work with people that you like and you respect, and if so, that's fantastic, but you may not, or you may not like all of them, and you may not respect all of them, and some of them may be really objectionable to you. They might have very different ideas. They might be racist. They might be reactionary. They might just be dreadful people. So we don't have to like people that we work with. But I think it's to the degree we can, if you can recognize that those relationships are also structural. What does that mean? You're all employed by the same entity for the same purpose. You're being employed so that someone can make money off of your labor. And that should unite you. That's what you share. So you may not agree about the same sports team or politicians or anything else about a worldview, but you can agree we're here for the same reason, which is someone is exploiting us so that we can survive, so we can pay our own bills. That's not only is that enough, that's pretty substantial. And on that platform, you can build a relationship.
Well, maybe we should clarify that this book is largely about an organizer within a workplace, right? Talking with their coworkers as opposed to somebody coming from the outside into a workplace. One-on-one conversations, as you're right, are an essential building block to organizing. What efforts should be made to move from one-on-one conversation to group discussion?
Thank you, CS. I love this question. So again, has anyone here gotten training as an organizer in which you're told that the main thing are one-on-one conversations? Is that familiar to some of you? Well, I'm very opinionated about this. I think, of course, one-on-one conversations, you have to meet people, right? You don't know them. You got to say, hello, who are you? What do you do? What's your job? Like that. But the goal of organizing, for me, is always got to be collective. That's why we call it collective bargaining. And, you know, you are, when you become a union, it is you're forming a collective bargaining unit. So everything about capitalism is to put people in competition with each other. That's the nature of capitalism. The opposite of that, obviously, for those of us who think about it this way, would be a system in which we can cooperate. And unions can be sometimes the only space where we can really cooperate in truly meaningful ways. Cooperating means let's break down this individual isolation. Break it down however you can. Break down the competition, break down the fear of each other, whatever it is that interferes with our ability to function together in a group. Let's do that. So one-on-one conversations should always lead to small group discussion. Small group discussion where, like, you can actually make a safe space for people to say, what do you think about this issue, this problem we're having? What are your concerns about it? What are your hopes for it? What are you afraid of? What would you like to do? These kinds of questions. And I have found that that leads to extremely powerful organizing, deep relationship organizing.
Could you tell us a story about the group of workers at a commercial tree nursery who could not get their boss to set a schedule for summer work? And because I think this illustrates some things about initiative and planning and what workers can do on their own.
Right, let's see if I remember the details. So this was a few years ago. It was something I experienced in Vermont, where I lived for many years. So I had some young friends who were working at a tree nursery, and they loved the work, and their boss was like, very friendly to them, a kind of a hippie, you know, whatever. It was an organic nursery. That was all great. And they were I ran into them one day. They were very enervated because they had been trying to get the boss to set a summer schedule for them. Summer's a super busy time, nursery, as you might imagine. And everyone's got stuff going on in the summer, and you have, like, family trips and weddings, and you want to go here and there. And, like, he couldn't. And one day, he was gone on some kind of work thing, or he was gone for a week. His daughter worked for the nursery, and she saw what was going on, and she saw how incredibly frustrated people were. So she went around for a few days and did kind of one-on-one interviews with her coworkers to say, when would you like to have your vacation this summer? And she took notes of it. And then at the end of the week, Dad was still gone. She brought everybody together over lunch one day, and she said, I've put together this schedule that I think kind of respects to the greatest degree possible everything that you told me you wanted for your summer vacation. Take a look at it. She said they spent the next couple of hours reviewing the schedule. talking, changing, tweaking it. They said, this is great. This is great. He came back from his trip the next week. She presented it to him because everybody else was too scared to do so. He flew into a rage. He was appalled. How could you have done this? What were you thinking? He sort of flew off the handle, didn't show up for the next 2 days. And then like a day or two later, there was the summer schedule posted on the bulletin board as they had created it.
So let's say you are in a unionized workplace and your union stewards are not responsive. You know, they won't fight for you, for what you and your coworkers think makes sense in a particular situation. How should organizers conduct themselves in that context?
Well, let's ask, is there anybody here that's in a union? Anybody in a union where you feel the stewards are not responsive? Okay. You don't have, that's the first problem. So Labor Notes, some of you know Labor Notes, what it is. It's a magazine we've been publishing for almost 50 years. And the reason Labor Notes exists is because of bad unions. And unfortunately, there are just a lot of them. So I think our position, I'm assuming everyone in this room would agree, we want to challenge capitalism in any possible way that we can. I assume that's a fair assumption for people that are at an anarchist book fair. How do you do that? You unite as workers. What is that called? That's called a union. So we need unions, but we actually need unions that can fight. Because if you just have unions that are just collecting your dues and not really doing anything, you're not going to win. You're not going to win. You're given into the system. So unions that are not willing to fight do not help. They actually hurt. Because now you're trapped in an organization which is not doing its job, and which makes you frustrated and cynical. So Labor Notes' position for 50 years has been, let's help workers find ways to reform their unions so they can fight. And the key to that turns out to be radical participatory democracy, which we sometimes also think of as rather close to anarchism. I think of it as quite close to anarchism, meaning bottom-up, horizontal, a lot of power at the bottom, transparency, openness, and make sure that the people who are your officers, your union, and your staff, their job is not to be a boss. We don't need union bosses. You need people who are coordinating activity, who are making sure the money is coming in and out properly, guard against corruption. There's some things for them to do, but they shouldn't be bosses. And what we say in Labor Notes is you can't fight the boss if you have to fight the union boss. So union reform, democratic union reform, is really what this is all about and what Labor Notes is all about. And it is quite possible, and for you in IBEW, I have good news. Have you heard of the caucus? IBEW has been a very, very top-down and at different times in its history, quite corrupt union. And this caucus, which stands for Caucus of Rank and File Electrical Workers, CREW, is one of many what we call democratic reform caucuses that have been blossoming in the last 10 years in particular. And that's what we do. CSEA needs a caucus. And the Labor Notes website, we have also just published a guide to, it's called A Guide to Building a Reform Caucus in Your Union. And it's a really rich resource that reflects our learning from the last 50 years about how to do this. And that's just available on the website.
I want to ask you about another vignette presented in your book. This is about nurses in a short-staffed hospital emergency department constantly being asked to take extra shifts. Now, under the contract, overtime was voluntary. But for a variety of reasons, the nurses always agreed to do the overtime. So how did the nurses respond?
Okay, so short staffing. This is a very direct response and mechanism in response to the decay of the current capitalist empire. This is just a symptom of what happens at the end of a certain life cycle of capitalism, which is the ability of the owning class to continue to make the rate of profits that they require to keep the system going has become smaller and smaller and smaller for reasons that just have to do with how capitalism works. And the one thing they can absolutely do, they can do all kinds of things to try and forestall the disaster, but the thing that they do the most easily is squeeze us hard. So the period of time that I grew up in, the post-World War II period, which we think of as a sort of a golden era, a little bubble in the U.S. anyway, of middle class, you know, strengthening working conditions and wages and so on. We all know the story, right? In a nuclear family, you could have one wage earner, they could work a set number of hours, you know, a 40-hour work week, and have enough money to live fairly comfortably, have a car, take a summer vacation, right, like that. Short staffing, when I began my work in the labor movement in the 70s, was not something people talked about. They talked about other problems, but short staffing was not it. And they also did not talk about bullying. Anybody here ever observe bullying in the workplace? Okay. It's universal now. It is the working conditions almost everywhere, all the time, in some form or another. And sometimes it's mean bullying, but sometimes it's very subtle. And it's like, oh, can you just cover the shift because someone just called in sick and you know how it would be. It would be so hard for the patients if you didn't cover her shift. And even though you've just worked two back-to-back 12-hour shifts, do you want to take a third one? So this operates on guilt. It operates on a sense of professional commitment and obligation. And it operates on wanting to help your coworkers. And sometimes it operates because you are desperate and you actually need the extra money, even if you would prefer not to do that. So if you're in a workplace where this is happening, the very best thing you can do is talk to your coworkers, starting one-on-one and then in small groups, and say, can we agree to not give in to that? As a group, can we agree to say no to the extra shift or the overtime or covering for our coworkers? Not because we don't care about the quality of the work. Of course, we care about our patients or our clients or our customers or our students, but because you are exploiting us past an acceptable level. If you do that, the boss is going to understand that you have figured something out that they don't want you to figure out, which is solidarity. You can make solidarity with your coworkers to withhold work, then they know that you've figured out the secret. And as the case happened with these nurses in an emergency room in a hospital that I was working with, helping their union, sure enough, after years of short staffing in the emergency room, all of a sudden they hired half a dozen nurses, something like that, to deal with the short staffing. So it works.
I think I'll ask you a couple more questions and then we can open it up. So setting realistic goals, right? And you write about how important it is to, set achievable goals. They might be small, right? Small scale, but they could possibly be built on and also maybe change workers' attitudes about what they feel they can do. So can you talk about thinking about goals to set and what achieving even small wins might do to worker power in the workplace?
Mm. So again, let me ask you, are any of you in workplaces where you would say your coworkers on a sort of day-to-day basis operate with a certain amount of fear? Fear of some kind of retaliation, loss of reputation, loss of benefits, loss of... So fear, yeah, it's fairly widespread. Some of the things that you need to overcome that are not only confidence from other people around you, yes, we can change a thing, but you need the lived experience. I took a risk with others, and I didn't die. That's actually, when people can experience that, it changes something for them. It's not something you can coerce people into. You can't argue them into it. You can't necessarily even use logic. You have to invite people in to have an experience in which things feel different. So again, I know Calix is an excellent organizer, has certainly done this. My friend Andrew here, excellent organizer, I've been able to observe over the years, does this consistently. You start to talk to people and you say, what's happening? What's going on? What do you care about? You talk to someone else. What do you care about? You find something that a few people care about. And then you say, why don't we get together and talk about what we might do about it? I'm thinking about your situation. Working as a janitor, one of my first experiences has not left me, it was in the late 1970s, I talk about it in the book, I had been hired by AFSCME, which I think CESEA is an AFSCME affiliate. Is that right?
Yeah, right.
Hi. And it was Montpelier, Vermont, smallest state capital in the country. And I'd been hired to organize and work with municipal units. So one of my early assignments was to go meet with school custodians, local school system. I can't remember exactly about what, but I was told, go talk to the guy who's the president of the custodians bargaining unit. So I went to a local high school or middle school and went, you know, to the secretary, the front desk. I said, where can I find this guy? And she said, oh, he's going to be in his office. Their office was in the boiler room, of course. So I went down to the boiler room, but nobody was there. So I had to ask around, you know. Then it turned out there were no custodians in the building. Where did they go? It turned out that they had just heard that morning about a change in schedule. So the change in schedule was... the boilers in the schools, especially in the cold place like Vermont, right? You go through the winter. If they were to fail on a cold winter night, you could have burst pipes. It could be very serious. You know, it would be extremely expensive. And they were worried because the system was kind of a little old in this building. And so they changed the schedule to require all the custodians to go on rotating shifts. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there would be a custodian in the building posted in case the boiler went down. Of course, they hadn't talked to the custodians about it. So they were pissed off. So what did they do? They got together, they talked with each other. By the time I caught up with them, they were already in the superintendent's office. They just walked down the street to the superintendent's office and they'd yelled at him a bunch and said, this is not, you know, it's not gonna work. By the time I got there, he changed the schedule. He listened to what they recommended. And that was that. And then they went back to work. You would have to say this was small, right? It was a schedule change. What was critical about it, what was important about it, was that they understood that they knew more about their work and their lives and the boiler than anyone else. And they were the ones who actually should make a decision about how this was going to be done. They were able to talk to each other, not wait for some boss to tell them how it's going to go and what it's going to look like. They did that. They came back from the meeting. I was a kid, really. I was like in my mid-20s. And I was so in awe of it. And all I did was say, tell me what you did. Tell me how this happened. And they told me, which is how it's ended up in this book almost 50 years later. That's the quality of a small thing that we can do that gives you the ability to keep going.
So you help arrange a meeting of coworkers, and the turnout is really low. So people might say, where is everybody? You might blame those who didn't show up, or blame yourself for not drumming up a stronger turnout. What might you do instead?
Well, first of all, I've never found that blame is a very healthy tactic or strategy in organizing. It doesn't really lead to very good results. So if you are disappointed, actually disappointment is not very helpful. In fact, I have a chapter in my book, which I think is called Swear Off Disappointment. So we can't afford squandering our emotional energy on being disappointed because it's not useful. It doesn't bring us anything. Disappointment in your coworkers, you know, they're not working hard enough, they're not aggressive enough, they're not stepping up, they're not becoming active in the union, they're too conservative, whatever our disappointment in our coworkers are, is going to weaken our ability to see, to be in solidarity with them, to find something in them we can respect and help develop. We can be disappointed in our bosses, but we shouldn't waste our energy there either, because they're just doing their job, right? Their job is to exploit us. Their job is to control us. Their job is to make us feel insecure and to doubt ourselves. That's, again, it's not personal. This is just what you have to do to keep people coming to work under bad conditions day after day. You have to doubt yourself and doubt your own power. So don't waste time being disappointed with the boss. Definitely don't spend your energy being disappointed by coworkers. And so my recommendation is any interaction you get to have with any coworker at any time, you find something in that other person that you can respect, something you can agree with, something you can feel an affinity with. It may just be a little thing, but find it. That's what I think organizers do, can do, and should do. And when you reflect your respect for someone on that basis, they start to change. They will start to feel something more and different about themselves. Their sense of self-doubt, lack of confidence, will diminish, and their sense of dignity and purpose and meaning will increase because you have offered that to them. And that's the kind of coworkers you want. So that's what I recommend.
Ellen David Friedman, talking about her new book, Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard.
Thank you again. I just want to return to your comments about complaining and the usefulness of complaining. And my question would be, what's your opinion on differentiating between like gripes and grievances? So in my local, the IBEW, really our biggest hurdle right now is actually our own local leadership for a lot of different reasons. They're common to a lot of unions and all that, so don't have to get super into it. But I've seen a lot of people who have been trying to be oppositional figures or trying to confront the status quo lose a lot of credibility in rank and file's mind when they zero in on what rank and file sees as grievances and just hit them over and then hit them over and over and over again because they're fixated on them, and then they lose all credibility. So how do you work with people, whether they're, you know, in that line between rank and file and being oppositional and like figuring out what's a real grievance and what's like a gripe that's gonna burn you out?
That is such a sophisticated question. Thank you. That is, it really shows, if I may say so, it shows me the seriousness that you are bringing to the question of reforming your union. Because that's at a deep level, that question. And I happen to have written a chapter about it. It's called Griping and Complaining. Let me see what I say. I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read a little bit. Complaining isn't the first step to organizing. It's the graveyard of organizing. Just ask any union steward who has listened to a member complain bitterly but refused to take action. There's probably no easier way for coworkers to communicate with each other than by complaining. It's the universal go-to for the informal work chat. Quote, can you believe what he just did? Quote, what were they thinking? Quote, I've had it with her. Quote, if I have to clean up after them one more time, dot, dot, dot. Those kinds of comments. And then I go on, but I'll say this. Look, complaining to let off steam, if you take no action to change the problem, demonstrates something that's far from organizing. It demonstrates powerlessness. It's like saying, this is wrong, it's unfair, it's hard for me to manage, but now that I've pointed out, I'm going to go back living with it because there's nothing else I can do. So I think you really hit on it. And if there are some people who are oppositional and are just getting up again and again, if I understood you correctly, and just complaining sort of about the same thing over and over and over again, they are just broadcasting their powerlessness and driving people away. They are not even remotely encouraging anyone to come towards them for any productive purpose. So I would say that if you see yourself as a person, and I'm guessing you do because you're sitting here and participating, so I'm guessing you do see yourself as someone who wants to change the culture in your union, I think my recommendation would be don't pay too much attention to those complainers. They're not important for you. Instead, be looking around, be keeping your eyes open, as I'm guessing you probably already are, for the person who recognizes what the complaint is about, said, okay, I agree, that is a problem, but their attitude about it is different, which is there something we might be able to do about it? And then again, getting into conversation with that person, saying, do you think, should we talk to some other people to see if they agree? Talk to them, find them. Again, see if you can get even a very small group, 3-4 people's big enough, so that at the next union meeting, after the complainer is done complaining, one of you can get up and say, you know, we've been thinking about this, and we think, what about doing the following? And then offer a suggestion or say, we have already decided to take some action on this. This is what we're doing already. And again, it can be a small thing. I have found that there are some people who are doing endless complaining because they just don't know what else to do. And they might be really happy when they see a group doing something different. There are other people who complain endlessly because they've built a whole thing for themselves around it. It's their identity. It's their purpose in life. It's the whole structure of their personality somehow. And you may not want to spend too much time worrying about them. They may not be your best allies.
Anybody else with a question for Ellen?
I was wondering if you had any tips for organizing a really small workplace. I only work with one other person, so there's only two of us. But we have, because we're contract workers, we have basically 5 managers. Most of them are from the building that we work with, but we also have a couple managers from the company we work at. So we're outnumbered 2 to 5. But so I was just wondering if you had any tips.
Oh, my God. This is so typical. So many managers. Wait till the managers start to organize. So you said you're subcontracted. So wherever you work, are there other subcontracted employees doing custodial maintenance work, but just in different facilities?
One of the maintenance guys is not a subcontractor. I think we're the only subcontractors that are like mainstays. And one of the maintenance guys is actually a manager of the subcontractor, which is us. And he's the worst. He's our main problem. He tried to push out our company, which would put us out of a job.
Mm.
He thinks that we can get the entire job done, which is a whole building. It's 5 floors, 4 floors, sorry. in, he thinks that we can get that done in 4 hours with just the two of us. It's a dorm, and there's a myriad of other issues. He's been caught lying as well. He lied about, he said I was late and tried to get me in trouble for a bunch of other things as well. So the other maintenance workers are actually part of the problem because they're our manager as well.
Yeah. You know, one of the rules for us for organizing is they, that is the bosses and the boss class, they have the money and they have the power. What do we have? We have the numbers. So we do need numbers. But if you're in a situation where it's just you and one other person doing the same job, the question I would ask is, are there any other workers, not managers, but any other workers that you're in contact with or could be in contact with who you could talk with, who you could just meet and talk with? So on a campus, so this is higher education, this is at a college or?
It's SUNY Broome, yeah.
So they're going to be people doing maintenance. They're going to be skilled trades workers. There's going to be dining, you know, food service workers. There's going to be clerical, technical, administrative staff. There's going to be grad students and adjuncts and professors, undergraduate student workers. Like every college campus has, everyone is working. I mean, the students are working, right? The undergrads are working. The grads are working. Like everyone is working. It doesn't mean you're going to have access to all of them, I know. And you're working, right? So you don't have a lot of free time to talk with people. But if you can figure out any way to start meeting and having some conversations with any other workers and just say, how's it going for you? What's your work like? Do you know who we are? You know, we're subcontracted. We do this work. I often think that the way we change a workplace is by beginning to focus on relationships and changing the culture so that people can talk to each other and learn about each other. Again, not just to gripe and complain, but to build something, even just build some familiarity. You know, oh yeah, I know you. And then you see someone walking towards the parking lot or on your lunch break or something like that. And you're starting to build a small culture of we can talk with each other about what's happening to us at work. Changing that attitude is just, it's golden. And you may find that if, for example, there's something that's happening in your workplace that's really intolerable, and now you have some, you've made some contacts, some people that you feel friendly towards who know who you are, you might think, well, I'm going to get in touch with them. I'm just going to tell them about what's happening and see if there's some way we can figure out to respond to it together. So that's what I'd recommend.
Thank you.
You bet.
I wanted to ask about models of labor organizing outside of the existing formal framework of recognized unionization. You were talking about like union reform movements and rank and file caucuses being an important aspect of that. I think that makes a lot of sense, but at the same time, I think that it's clear that a lot of existing unions are at best legacy organizations, that the framework of collective bargaining or recognition of unions has become extremely constrained by an NLRB that does not have our interests in mind. Obviously, there are possibilities for creating collective power through collective organizing in workplaces, but I'm wondering how you envision the balance between worker organizing outside of the legal framework of unionization and collective bargaining and efforts to try to overcome the limitations that currently plague unions as they exist in the present as legacy organizations. Thank you.
Oh, Andrew, what a great segue. Well, first of all, Andrew is a comrade who is doing this very thing at Holy Cross in Worcester, where he is adjunct faculty. I'm looking at Adam in the back of the room, who is a librarian at Cornell. I'm sure there are others of you here in this category. We are certainly at a moment where the ability to turn to the labor laws in the private sector, that's the National Labor Relations Act, or in the public sector, it's whatever your state labor laws are. The idea that we can turn to those and expect that we are actually going to find a framework that's going to really help us to solve our problems, that's illusory. It's an illusion that is fast losing its base for many, many reasons, not the least of which is that that law, well, the NLRA, the private sector law, was passed in 1935 when the U.S. economy was built entirely on heavy manufacturing, auto, steel, coal, rubber, construction, I mean, right? It was a different economy. The economy now, education, healthcare, human services, building maintenance, retail, restaurants, these are, like, our economy is gonna deep change. The labor laws have not accommodated that, so that is one thing. The second thing is, of course, we've had 50 years of neoliberalism, in which the left and unions and any form of action against the market has been demonized very deeply. We've had one reactionary federal administration after another. Laws have been, and case laws, and the rights that do exist under the law, of course, have been diminished severely because bosses break the law all the time. They break the law because it's petty cash for them. Look at Starbucks. Right? What, if 500 stores have unionized or something like that? They're never going to get a contract. They just break the law, and then they pay the fines, if they ever get a fine, out of petty cash. Amazon is the largest employer after the federal government in this country and in many countries around the world. Unionizing Amazon is sort of a pipe dream. Oh, and the last example, federal workers. So some of you may know that in this last year, 1 million federal workers have lost their jobs. They've just been forced out by this administration. And about 750,000 were told, you don't have a collective bargaining agreement or a union anymore. Trump just announces, I'm dissolving your union, I'm dissolving your contract, that's that. So I've been doing a lot of work with federal unionists. And so for these two converging forces, one, people who are trying to unionize, but they find they can't because the law is so broken and they are so outspent by the boss, and then for workers who have had union recognition but are losing it, I say the same thing. There's only one thing that determines whether or not you have a union, and that's whether or not you are organizing with your coworkers. A union is not something the boss gets to decide for you or the government gets to decide for you. It's what you decide for yourself when you talk to each other, when you find common cause, when you find shared themes, when you figure out how to fight together. Do not let those distinctions that the boss is going to impose on you or the law is going to impose on you, do not let that limit your thinking. So, for example, a friend back there, Adam, who's the librarian, he's organizing at Cornell, and we just had a conversation earlier today. He said, well, I don't know, we're trying to organize, but I'm told I'm a supervisor, and many of you know that supervisors are prohibited from being in unions by law. And I said, oh, no, don't you let that stop you. You just go ahead, you talk to your coworkers, bring people together, learn how to trust each other, learn how to fight. If and when someone ever tells you, you can't be doing this because you're a supervisor, then you turn to the people that you work with whom you've been building solidarity relationships. You say, what do you think? Are we gonna be able to work together or not? And if you've been doing your organizing, they'll say, hell yes, we're gonna keep working together. So we're in a moment where the legal framework is breaking down so quickly. Some people consider this devastating and a terrible problem. Others of us think it's a fabulous opportunity. Your situation here, our comrade right here, you said you work for a subcontractor. The law would say you can't be in a union with permanent, regular employees of the university, right? Because subcontractors are not supposed to be in the same union. But you build relationships, you are in the same union. You figure out how coworkers get together and solve problems, you are in the same union, and that's all that matters. And keep doing what you're doing, Andrew, because You are a case in point.
So the book is Keep Going, A Guide to Organizing When It's Hard. Can you join me in thanking Ellen David Friedman?